It's often assumed that Abraham Lincoln was a man of firm principles and strong core values, but his positions on the issue of slavery shifted quite a bit over the course of his lifetime. In his latest book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, Eric Foner takes a closer look at the man many consider to be the greatest president in American history. Mr. Foner is DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University. His latest book, this one, is published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hello.
Hi, nice to see you again.
Lincoln grew up in Kentucky and Indiana and had relatives who owned slaves. How did that influence his views on slavery?
Well, his parents opposed slavery. He says that in a little campaign autobiography that he wrote in 1860. But he lived among slave owners. More important, he grew up among people who had moved out of the South. He grew up in Indiana, then Illinois, who were not slave owners, but nonetheless shared many of the racial prejudices of the South in that period. And that certainly affected Lincoln's own outlook for part of his career anyway.
Henry Clay represented Kentucky in both the Senate and the House while Lincoln was still a young man. He was called the Great Compromiser. Was that something that Lincoln aspired to? Did he admire Clay?
He admired Clay enormously. Clay was one of these Upper South slave owners who hated slavery and was always trying to get Kentucky to develop some plan of getting rid of slavery. And for much of his life, Lincoln adopted, you might say, Clay's plan, which was gradual emancipation with monetary payment to the slave owners and the colonization or the settlement of former slaves outside of the country in Africa or Central America, something like that.
Inspired by what James Monroe had done?
Well, Monroe in Liberia, Thomas Jefferson, another president that Lincoln admired enormously, was also a strong colonizationist. I think the idea here is you needed the consent of slave owners if you're going to abolish slavery. Slavery was protected by the Constitution. It was protected by state law. And slave owners like Henry Clay did not want a large free black population around.
Does anybody bring this up when the originalists talk about holding firm to the Constitution when we look at today's laws?
Sometimes the less than admirable views of our founders tend to be put to the side. You know, of course, that's not in the Constitution colonization, but if we're going to go back and just try to reenact the views of the founding fathers, we may find that some of their views are a little bit less exalted than we might want to think.
Now, Henry Clay opposed the annexation of Texas because he feared it would inject the slavery issue into politics.
And Lincoln was a follower of Clay at that time, and he was a Whig, and he actually said he wasn't all that interested in the issue of Texas, but he opposed the Mexican War, which was actually quite popular, the war in Illinois, and some people said that sort of torpedoed his political career in the late 1840s.
Now, Lincoln was a Whig. There was no Republican Party at that time.
Right. The Republicans are not founded till the 1850s to oppose the westward expansion of slavery, and Lincoln becomes the most eloquent, most important spokesman for the Republican Party in the pivotal state of Illinois.
Why did he leave the Whigs?
Well, the Whigs kind of left him,
well,
as he
kind
often
of
said.
Decline.
They collapsed in the wake of the slavery issue. They could not resolve the tensions between their northern and southern members, and the Republican Party emerges to as purely a northern party to try to prevent the westward expansion of slavery. It's not an abolitionist party, but Lincoln always said that the ultimate end of slavery was something he, you know, wanted to work toward.
But as late as 1858, Lincoln spoke out against suffrage and other rights for free blacks. That's just 3 years before he was elected president.
2 years before, yeah. That's in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, of course, Lincoln was accused frequently of favoring, quote-unquote, Negro equality, which was sort of like the nuclear weapon of politics. And he denied it. On the one hand, he said blacks are entitled to the basic natural rights of all mankind. That's why slavery is wrong. But the right to vote, the right to hold office, civil rights, he said those are determined by the individual states. And at that point, he said he was not in favor of free blacks exercising those rights. He would change his mind about that during the Civil War.
But it was the Civil War that made him change his mind?
It was the Civil War that made many people change their minds about many things. It was the greatest crisis in American history. I think in Lincoln's case, it was two critical things. One was the service of black soldiers. You know, in the second 2 years of the last 2 years of the Civil War, something like 200,000 black men served in the Union Army and Navy. And Lincoln came to think that that service had staked a claim to citizenship in the new nation. He dropped the idea of colonization from 1863 onward, and he came to think of America as being a biracial society, which he had not really thought about it in that way earlier.
Although he had said that blacks and whites were incapable of living together in this
country. Well, he said that up through 1862, and then he stopped saying it, and in fact, at the very end of his life, he advocated the right to vote for some black men, including these former soldiers. So he really changed enormously in the last 2 years of the Civil War.
Was it an expedient change, or do you think that he went through a major
cycle? No, I think Lincoln really, you know, once you put blacks in the army, once you drop this idea of colonizing them outside of the country, then you've got to start really thinking through what their role is going to be in a post-slavery world. And also, Lincoln, for the first time in the Civil War, actually came into contact with prominent black men and talented black men. He didn't know any black people before the Civil War except a barber, you know, in his hometown. Now he met Frederick Douglass and he met Alexander Crummell and he met Martin Delaney and he met delegations of black petitioners. And his views expanded, his racial views expanded. He came to appreciate black people on a bigger spectrum than he had in the past.
Was Frederick Douglass impressed by Lincoln?
Douglass was very impressed. I think the two of them saw each other as self-made men. You know, both of them had risen from very humble circumstances to being very prominent. And, you know, Douglass, who criticized Lincoln strongly for his what he considered slowness on emancipation, also said, you know, Lincoln is a man who never made me feel the difference of race. He treated me as an equal. He talked to me. Lincoln is actually the first president in American history who actually invited black people into the White House to talk to them about public issues. No blacks had entered the White House before this except as slaves.
He believed that border states like Kentucky were key to ending slavery. Why?
Well, the four border states, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, and Delaware, remained in the Union. So, you know, their loyalty was essential to pursuing the Civil War. And Lincoln, early on in the war, started this policy of trying to get those border states to adopt voluntary plans of emancipation. They said no. That was one of Lincoln's big disappointments. They weren't interested in giving up their slaves.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act forced Lincoln to take a stand.
Well, a stand on the expansion of slavery into the West. That's 1854. That leads to the rise of the Republican Party. But it also makes Lincoln see that slavery is now going to be the number one issue in American politics. In his previous career, he hadn't really said very much about slavery.
He did support the Missouri Compromise.
Well, the Missouri Compromise was passed when he was 11 years old, but of course the Kansas-Nebraska Act repeals the Missouri Compromise, which had prohibited slavery in most of the West. And that's what Lincoln, he said, we got to go back to the Missouri Compromise and reinstate this prohibition of slavery's westward expansion.
My guest is Eric Foner, whose latest book is The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. It is published by Norton. What state was the country in when Lincoln was elected in 1860? Isn't his predecessor, James Buchanan, considered to be one of the worst presidents we've ever had?
Absolutely. One of the two or three worst.
And then the guy who followed him is
another competitor. Lincoln is surrounded by the worst presidents, Andrew Johnson after him and Buchanan before him. You know, the country was obviously on the verge of a tremendous crisis. It was totally, you know, Lincoln's own election shows how divided it was. He didn't receive any votes in most of the southern states. And yet by carrying all the northern states, he was able to get a majority in the Electoral College. So the very map of the election showed that this was a deeply, deeply divided country.
Wasn't it assumed by people in the South that ending slavery was something that he had set out to do?
Well, so why did Southerners secede when Lincoln is elected?
But he didn't say that at the time.
Well,
he changed his mind while he was already president.
Well, the thing is, Lincoln had always made clear his deep hatred of slavery. He called it a monstrous injustice in 1854. He said all through the 1850s, we want to place it in the course of ultimate extinction. Southerners didn't want to wait around for that ultimate. You know, at one point, Lincoln said it might be 100 years, but they did not think they were safe under a president who opposed slavery, even though there was very little Lincoln as president could do to actually attack slavery where it existed.
Was the North so solidly against slavery?
Not at all.
In fact, New York City supposedly was very sympathetic.
Well, New York's economy was tied into the cotton trade of the South, but I think the North was pretty united against the westward expansion of slavery. People wanted to go out into the West, become farmers, etc., on their own. They didn't want slave plantations out there. And the South felt that that was essential to their, you know, their the future of their own institutions. So Northerners were not mostly abolitionists, obviously, but I think by the time of Lincoln's election, most Northerners had this kind of visceral sense that there's something deeply wrong with this institution of slavery.
Was Lincoln surprised when the South actually seceded?
I think he was surprised that secession went as far as it did. I think everyone figured, well, South Carolina, you know, they're pretty extreme. That'll happen. But I don't think he expected, you know, seven states to secede before his inauguration. And then once the war begins, four more states secede. Lincoln and many Republicans, I think, underestimated the strength of secession sentiment in the South and therefore didn't really appreciate how long and bloody this war was likely to be.
Well, he used the word union throughout much of his writing. But it's interesting, he took the word union out of the final draft of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, during the war, Lincoln's language shifts from union to nation, which is an indication of what is happening as a result of the Civil War. A union is a collection of independent entities. A nation is a unified single thing. And Lincoln, you know, by the end of the war, by the Gettysburg Address, one, you know, he's talking about the nation founded in the American Revolution. This notion of a unitary nation really is created in the Civil War in some ways that didn't exist. It didn't exist before it.
You say he always chose his words very carefully.
Well, he was a brilliant writer, you know, and reading him, you must admire his brilliant command of the English language. Even though he only had 1 year of formal schooling, he was totally self-educated. But I think because he was such a careful writer, I think you can analyze his speeches, his writings, and really figure out what he is believing. It's not like there's a secret, you know, correspondence elsewhere that shows that he believes something else. He meant what he said, and he chose what he said extremely carefully.
And he never had to say, as so many politicians do today, oh, I misspoke when I said that.
No, you know, he changed during the course of his career, as most people do as they mature. But at any one point, he was very consistent. And so, you know, you can really take him at his word about what he believed and thought the future of the country ought to be.
Was he a very hands-on president? How much did he get involved in the whole military campaign?
He got very involved in the military issues, dealing with generals, etc., and he got very involved in the managing the slavery issue. On other questions, he was totally hands-off. Economic policy, which was extremely important, he left that to the Secretary of the Treasury. Foreign policy, he left that to Secretary of State Seward. He, you know, intervened once or twice, but he basically kept his intervention on the military and slavery fronts where he wanted to determine policy without anybody else, you know, telling him what to do.
And you say that watching the performance of black soldiers had an effect on him. Interestingly, Washington said the same thing during the Revolutionary War.
Well, in both wars, the Revolution and the Civil War, at the beginning, they said, we don't want blacks in the army. You know, black people volunteered, and they said, no, this is a white war. And in both cases, eventually, they needed the manpower, and they enlisted blacks. Now, Washington only had about, I think, 8,000 black soldiers. In the Civil War, it's 200,000.
But Washington was fighting against a lot of black soldiers because they were offered emancipation by the British.
The British, more black people got freedom through the British than through the American army. But and that's something the South was not in a position to do, of course, during the Civil War. At the very, very end, they talk about enrolling blacks in this Confederate army, but it never really happens. And, you know, slavery is like a weakness to the Confederacy, and Lincoln sees this eventually, and the emancipation is meant to undermine the fabric of Southern resistance.
Well, in Lincoln's view, was ending slavery more important for the country as a whole or for the African Americans who
were
slaves?
Well, all of the above. You know, Lincoln develops during the war a real compassion, I think, for these slaves and what they have experienced. I mean, you look at his second inaugural address. He talks about the whipping of slaves. He talks about the theft of their labor for 250 years. He really is asking the country to think seriously about what you know, what is the obligation of justice in this case? So it's not just the nation, it's the black people themselves and their claim upon the conscience of the nation.
Well, right now, every time anybody proposes some change, let's say, to fight climate change, we are told that it will just the economic repercussions will be too high. Well, slavery played a major role in the economic structure of the country.
The slaves themselves represented the largest concentration of property in the United States, and it's astounding, a word Lincoln used in his second inaugural, it's astounding that this property was abrogated, abolished with no compensation whatsoever to the owners. This is one of the largest destructions of private property in all of history.
It went against what he had been saying all those years.
Well, he had changed his mind with the Emancipation Proclamation. He dropped the idea, as we said, of colonization. He dropped the idea of compensation, although it pops up once or twice later on. And he drops the idea of gradualism. The emancipation is immediate and it's uncompensated. It's one of the more radical steps in 19th century history.
What was his 10% plan?
Well, that was a plan for Reconstruction, where he said if 10% of the voters, that is white people, from before the Civil War will take an oath of allegiance to the United States, they can then form a new government in the South. Particularly, he's interested in Louisiana. It wasn't a blueprint for the post-war South as much as a way to try to detach a state from the Confederacy. Many radicals opposed it because it didn't give any role to black people in forming new state governments.
Well, Reconstruction became a – it did radicalize the country for a little while.
And absolutely.
Then there was the retrenchment.
Absolutely.
And partly helped by Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor.
Well, Lincoln's didn't live to try to implement a Reconstruction
but
policy.
But what did he imagine?
It's very hard to know what he imagined. I think it would be wrong to think that when the war ended, he had a clearly worked out plan of Reconstruction. Reconstruction during the war was part of the war. It was an effort to win the war. It was not a blueprint, as I said, for the South after the war. And I think we could expect that in Reconstruction, as happened during the war, Lincoln would have changed, would have grown, would have listened to Congress, would have made a deal with Congress. There's no way of knowing what 1 or 2 years after his actual death Lincoln would have been thinking.
Had he come to believe that blacks and whites could eventually coexist in this country?
Absolutely. He dropped the idea of colonization. He called for giving some black men the right to vote. In the Emancipation Proclamation, he calls upon the freed slaves to go to work for reasonable wages. Interesting, he puts the word reasonable in there. In the South, they're no longer going to leave the country. This is going to be a biracial society. He realizes that eventually.
Is that what drove John Wilkes Booth to assassinate him?
Well, some people claim that Booth was there when Lincoln delivered his last speech at the White House in April 1865, where he called for some black men getting the right to vote, and that Booth said, "I will run him through now," because, you know, they were first planning to kidnap Lincoln, the conspirators. This is, you know, maybe apocryphal, maybe correct, but certainly Booth hated Lincoln because of his hostility to slavery and quite likely because Lincoln was moving toward greater recognition of the rights of black people.
Many people compared Barack Obama to Lincoln and to FDR during the presidential campaign. Do you see any similarities?
Well, you know, I think one similarity is that both Obama and Lincoln became national figures through speeches, through oratory. You know, Lincoln didn't hold any office at all from 1859 to when he was elected president. He became well known through his speeches. Obama also, he was in the Senate, but nobody really associates him with any major legislation. It was eloquent, powerful speeches that made both of them, you know, major political figures. So I would, other than that, I think many of these comparisons were, shall we say, a little ahistorical.
But I suspect nobody, perhaps Martin Luther King will have written a speech that will be memorized by high school kids the way the Gettysburg Address is.
Well, one of the reasons you could memorize it is it only took 2 minutes to deliver. We have lost the notion of less is more nowadays.
Eric Foner will be in a panel discussion tonight at 6:15 at the Davis Auditorium on Columbia University's campus. That's at 2960 Broadway. For details, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His latest book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. It is published by Norton, and I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Always nice to be here to talk to you.